On a Friday, here's where we are, everybody. Some big picture economics. Facebook has its eye on you, and Wi-Fi from way, way back. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. It is Friday, the 27th day of May. Glad you could be with us, everybody. We are going to get 3 days off from business and economics this weekend, or you could if you so choose, I suppose. I do so choose. But before we go, a couple of brief moments of live radio to dissect the happenings since Monday last. John Carney is at the Wall Street Journal. Lynette Lopez is at Business Insider. They are both in our studios in New York. Hey, everybody.
Hi, Kai.
Hi, Kai.
All right, Lynette, we're going to start with you and with gross domestic product. The feeble growth rate of the American economy came in this morning at 0.8% for the quarter on an annualized basis.
Wow.
What?
Wow.
I know. See, that's the wah-wah trombones. We should get the wah-wah trombones for the GDP, but that's a whole different thing. What is going on that we can't get anything growing?
I mean, the world is there's no demand around the world. You know, everything is slowing down. Commodities prices are down. There's a strong dollar. Everything's weak. And what's really sad about this GDP report, the thing that really makes me go, is the fact that corporations are sitting on record amounts
of
cash.
Of right.
Piles and piles of money, but they are not spending it. They're not reinvesting it in the economy. Capital expenditures are incredibly low. And so these people are just sitting on this stuff and waiting. Pay people more. Invest in materials. Do something. You guys could help us out. And they're not doing anything.
John Carney, what is one to do about this? Because 0.8% is not satisfactory.
No, it's way too low. And it's troubling because there's slowdowns in China. Europe is still a little shaky. But there's nothing, that you could point to that's fundamentally wrong or scary that should be keeping growth that low. And so that's troubling because you get this number, then people say, oh, man, the economy is really bad, and react to it by, saving a little more and not spending, which just slows down the economy even more.
And yet, no less a person than Janet Yellen, PhD, chair of the Federal Reserve of the United States of America, said today, Lynette, in a Q&A up at Harvard, there is nothing wrong with us raising rates in the next couple of months in this economy. What? Explain the disparity, because when the Fed raises rates, it's a signal that everything is good.
Well, she's saying that our economy is healthy. But if you look around the world, there's a completely different story. China is a disaster. So is Brazil. That's the seventh largest economy. Europe is working out its issues. Greece has a few more months on the table. Don't even get started with that stuff. So the rest of the world is a mess. Janet's saying, we look okay. Like, we're still strong doing our thing. It's time to raise rates.
So let's put an end to that.
Exactly, John. How do you make sense of that?
Totally.
I mean, the day that they come out and raise rates, what's going to happen, John? Everybody's going to go, oh, my gosh,
Well, this is what she's trying very hard to avoid, which is why she made her speech at Harvard today, why there's a whole bunch of Fed speeches coming on, because they really want everybody to be very well prepared for the fact that they are going to raise rates sometime quite soon. And so they're trying to say, look, guys, we're really serious. This time we're really, really doing it. And the funny thing is, the market only still half believes them. People are saying, I don't know. They head faked us before. Maybe they'll head fake us again. So people still think maybe this is September rather than December. Because remember, they were going to raise in September. And everybody it didn't happen.
And then remember what happened after December, which is the entire world went, oh, my God.
That's what
we're going to blow.
That's what I'm saying.
There are a lot of Wall Street analysts out there, especially Goldman came out with this big note today that was like, hey, we don't know if that's going to happen again. Like, maybe it's not going to happen. Maybe everything's going to be fine. But all the elements for another disaster are assembling. Commodities prices are going down. The dollar is strong.
Disaster is a very strong word. Disaster is a very strong word. Let's not go there.
I only use strong words, Kai.
All right. So
no weak words.
We have a minute left, and I want to run something by you guys that I ran by Lee Gallagher and I forget who it was, honestly. Maybe Gura a couple of weeks ago. There's going to come a point where the election we have today is the election that we're going to have on – sorry. The economy we have today is the economy we're going to have on Election Day. And I want to know from you, John, if we're there. Is there going to be substantive change in the economy between now and November the 8th?
No, especially if the Fed raises rates, we'll still have a very, very slow growth period, and people will be voting, on the fears. You know, who knows? Maybe, you know, and I don't know which way that cuts politically.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Do you make GDP great again, or
and nothing makes sense anymore? Right. Nothing makes sense. John and I are quitting our jobs.
Well, so Lynette, you get the last words in the 17 seconds we have left. Are we now dealing with the economy we're going to have on election day?
Who knows? You know, I mean, I'm inclined to believe John. I think I don't see any source of global growth. Maybe the Chinese will ramp up their property market again and we'll all go into this big, like,
yeah, right,
fun bubble. Who knows? I don't.
All right,
I quit.
Well, we're not yet. Lynette Lopez at Business Insider, John Carney at The Wall Street Journal. Thanks, you two.
All right, later, Kevin.
Thanks.
All
have a good weekend.
Have a good weekend. Quick corporate note as we move on. Verizon and its 40,000 striking wireline workers reached a tentative agreement today. 4 years would be the length of the new contract. $50 is not the price of a barrel of oil today. Crude can't quite get back to where it was earlier in the week, $49 and change. This was, for those keeping track, the last trading day of May 2016, which means today was your last chance to sell in May and go away. Traders, however, we're buying. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. If you already thought Facebook was everywhere, yeah, well, you ain't seen nothing yet. The company announced this week it's not only going to sell targeted ads to people on Facebook, people the company knows a whole lot about, by the way, but now it's also going to track and target ads to people when they are not on the site, and even if they don't have a Facebook account. But come on, who among us doesn't have a Facebook account, right? Well, apparently Marketplace's Kimberly Adams doesn't, so of course she got this story.
There are consequences to being the only person in your social group not on Facebook. I miss party invites, I don't know anyone's birthdays, and people actually contact my mom on Facebook when they're trying to track me down. But the internet for me is just a little less, let's say, filtered. Matt Hobbs is a partner with consulting firm PwC.
For you who doesn't have those types of accounts, you'd probably just be looking generically at the web and picking through everything that you see and deciding what's interesting to you.
And I like that. Spending time on social media tells the sites a lot about you, and that's valuable in targeting online ads. And Hobbs says the digital advertising market is very competitive.
It keeps growing. I think it's been around 20 years, but we're looking at projections over the next 5 years growing up to 240 billion U.S. globally.
And Facebook wants more of that market. The company already had some info on non-users who visited Facebook or partner sites. Now it will use it to target holdouts like me with ads the algorithms think will interest me. You know who else makes a lot of money doing that? Google. Nate Carter is with marketing firm Media Associates.
Facebook and Google are very much competing for the same ad dollars, and they've been going up against each other for years now.
Plus, he said, it's not like the big internet companies don't already know my business anyway. In Washington, I'm Kimberly Adams for Marketplace.
I'm obliged to mention that Kimberly is not entirely asocial on social media. You can get her on Twitter, if you like, at @KA_Marketplace. We're doing a story later on in the program about wireless spectrum, the airwaves through which broadcast and internet signals get to us. Right now, though, some news that's more about actual waves. Microsoft and Facebook have announced they're going to cooperate on building a new undersea data cable stretching from Virginia to Spain. Cables like that are nothing new, but they have traditionally been the purview of traditional telecommunications companies. Marketplace's Jed Kim explains why tech is getting into that game.
When you hear the official term, submarine cable, it's hard not to think of those sonar pings you see in something like The Hunt for Red October. While pings give some data, the cables give a lot more. Try all those animal videos we watch on the internet. Jeff Kagan is a telecoms industry analyst.
The internet and the cloud is going to continue to grow and to transform the way we do everything. And that means you got to have capacity.
For content providers, that's a lot of capacity to have to buy from the cable's owners, who have traditionally been telecom companies. That's why tech companies are getting into the game. Tim Strong is an analyst with Telegeography.
In the long term, it's cheaper for them to build a cable and provision it with their own equipment rather than constantly going to the third-party market and purchasing capacity from other operators, from carriers.
This latest cable will have the highest capacity across the Atlantic. One of the owners is a telecoms company. The others, Facebook and Microsoft, aren't. Are they pushing into the public utilities market? Strong says probably not.
They have such large capacity needs, these content providers, that we believe that they will use all of the capacity they're procuring essentially for themselves.
Neither Microsoft nor Facebook would give an interview for this story, but spokespeople for both confirmed the capacity would be for the companies. There are risks to laying cable. Strong says on average, 2 breaks a week happen globally, caused by anchors or fishing nets. There's even videos of sharks biting cables. You can watch that on, you know, the internet. I'm Jed Kim for Marketplace.
With the acknowledgement that any given political season will conjure up its own set of issues that everybody loves to bash, the global trading system does seem to have come in for a good bit of criticism this time around. The Democrats on the ballot aren't wild about free trade. The GOP candidates and the likely nominee specifically, ditto with a bullet. Luckily for us, we've got a reporter who lives and breathes international trade. Tracy Samuelson is her name, so we asked her to unpack how we got here.
This debate about raising tariffs, the potential for trade wars, it's not remotely new. And there's this kind of classic case study that always comes up.
This is a picture of Mr. Smoot and Mr. Hawley. They look like pretty good fellas.
Back in 1993, Vice President Al Gore and Ross Perot talked tariffs while debating the merits of NAFTA. Gore pulled out this framed black and white picture of Senator Reed Smoot and Representative Willis Hawley to give to Perot, evoking them as a cautionary tale.
They raised tariffs, and it was one of the principal causes, many economists say the principal cause, of the Great Depression.
Now, that's not quite right, says Douglas Irwin, an econ professor at Dartmouth College. But he says the Smoot-Hawley tariffs did worsen the Great Depression and slow recovery from it. Because when Congress raised tariffs in 1930, other countries returned the favor.
To the extent that other countries imposed barriers against our exports, you'd have fewer sales, you might have to lay off some workers, and it wasn't good for those who are selling to foreign markets.
Import tariffs also made buying foreign goods more expensive for U.S. consumers, a big reason to be wary of a trade war.
I think it's playing with fire because you don't know how the other country's going to react.
Irwin says we don't really see full-on trade wars anymore.
But we see little trade wars. Sometimes we see skirmishes. Sometimes we see battles.
Countries are increasingly trying to tilt the playing field in favor of their domestic producers, says Simon Evenet, a professor of economics at the University of St. Gallen in Switzerland. He tracks protectionist measures and says we've seen a big uptick in 2015, early 2016.
Most of the action is actually on promoting exports rather than restricting imports.
Even it says these programs can actually make stuff cheaper for consumers who buy foreign goods from companies subsidized by those foreign governments.
But of course, it's the import competing firms who face those rivals who suffer.
Given a level playing field, we can compete with anybody.
That's Leo Girard. He's the international president of United Steelworkers.
Our problem is that we're being asked to compete with countries that don't play by the rules.
So as a union guy, Girard's take on trade wars is a bit different from the academics.
We are in a trade war. We just haven't been fighting back. So what we need is stronger trade laws. We need to modernize our trade laws, and we need to enforce them so that the trading countries that we trade with will have a level playing field.
He says levying big tariffs on imports doesn't solve the problem. I'm Tracy Samuelson for Marketplace.
Coming up,
if there's a better technology, everyone should accept it.
Innovation from back in the day. But first, let's do the numbers. The Dow Industrial's up 44 points on this Friday. At the end of May, 0.25%, 17,873. The NASDAQ up 31 points, 2/3%, 49.33. The S&P 500 up 8 points, 0.4%, 2,909.
For the week, the Dow up 2.1%, the NASDAQ up 3.4%, the S&P 500 up 2.3%. Verizon, we told you about that deal they made with their striking workers. The company up nearly 0.9% today. T-Mobile down, though, 0.2%. Janet Yellen, as we talked about in the wrap, says a rate hike in the coming months might be, quote, appropriate. Banking, of course, is paying attention. Citigroup deposited 1%. Goldman Sachs, 0.6% higher. Bond prices fell. Yield on the 10-year Treasury note rose to 1.85%. You're listening to Marketplace. This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Rizdahl. You know how you get a couple of days off at the end of your work week, that thing called a weekend? Not everybody gets one, though. And farm workers in New York are today's example. A group of those farm workers are walking across the state to push state lawmakers to pass a bill that would make them eligible for overtime pay, day of rest, and the right to unionize. Eilish O'Neill met up with a group of them as they went through Manhattan.
Late Saturday afternoon, farmworkers and activists are making their way through Harlem and Washington Heights in Manhattan. Their feet may hurt from a long day of walking, but they're still enthusiastic. They're drumming, chanting, handing out flyers. A pair of them's on roller skates. The marchers are trying to right what they see as an historical wrong. You know all the labor laws we take for granted, like days off? They were passed back in the 1930s, during the New Deal. As part of the backroom compromising necessary to get them through, farm workers were left out. Since then, a handful of states have gone ahead and granted protections to farm workers anyway. But New York is not one of them. Here, farm workers still don't have the right to overtime pay, a day off, or collective bargaining, says New York State Senator Adriano Espaillat.
These are fundamental rights of every worker in New York State that have been denied to over 100,000 farm workers across the state of New York.
One of these excluded workers is Berta Garzon. She spent 21 years working on a duck farm in upstate New York.
Son 33 o 34 jaulas.
Garzon says she had to force feed more than 350 ducks three times a day. That meant she worked around the clock with never more than 5 hours off at a time. And she only got one day off a month. A bill currently before the New York Senate would make all that illegal.
If it was passed into law, it would essentially gut our agricultural industry.
This is Jeff Williams, Director of Public Policy at the New York Farm Bureau. He says if workers had the right to unionize, they could strike during harvest time, and farmers could lose their entire investment. Also, Williams says, farmers in New York have such narrow profit margins, they can't afford to pay workers more.
I talked with a vegetable farmer from central New York last week, and he's trying to unload a truckload of carrots. And he calls up the wholesaler and distributor and says, okay, what's the price today? He produced his for 21 cents per pound, but Michigan's paying 19 cents. And so the more you increase those labor costs, the more you get in that position where you can't produce food for what you're getting paid for.
It's not clear what the economic impact of this bill would be. Some economists say California's law, for example, led to more expensive produce and lowered wages for farm workers. Others argue those effects were negligible, and the main effect of the legislation was to reduce poverty. For people like Richard Witt, one of the leaders of the march and an Episcopal priest, this isn't about economics. This is about morality. He spent the past 20 years helping farm workers fight.
They want to know why they're being treated differently than others. So for them, it really is about treat us with dignity, respect that we're a key part of the agricultural system and the food system.
The marchers hope their protest will force state senators to bring the bill to a vote before they break for the summer. In New York, I'm Alicia O'Neill for Marketplace.
Next Tuesday, the FCC, the Federal Communications Commission, is going to do a little dabbling in the electromagnetic spectrum market. The FCC controls the airwaves, literally the radio frequencies that broadcasters and wireless companies use to get us the content that we want. They're going to buy back parts of that spectrum from traditional broadcasters, then turn around and sell them to wireless providers. Not, I know, the stuff of a gripping radio story, but that's kind of the point. Because 100 years ago, the fight over the airwaves was pretty dramatic, and more often than not, came down to a 40-year friendship between two men, a brilliant but troubled inventor named Edwin Armstrong and David Sarnoff, the head of the Radio Corporation of America, RCA. The story is told in a new book by Scott Woolley, which is called The Network. Scott, thanks for coming to the studio.
Thanks for having me.
Tell me about these two guys, Edwin Armstrong and David Sarnoff. Who were they?
Well, they were born both around the same time, 1890, 1891, and they started hanging out together at the very dawn of the 20th century, just as the wireless industry was taking off. So before there was AM radio, there was the wireless telegraph. Mm-hmm. And these guys started out, Sarnoff was a Russian immigrant, and he came over and was working for the Marconi Wireless Telegraph Company. And Armstrong was this brilliant inventor who had invented this new device, this vacuum tube amplifier that really made radio work.
David Sarnoff turns this thing that Edwin Armstrong came up with into a business. Did he understand what he was doing? I mean, give me a sense of him as an entrepreneur and as a businessman.
He was obsessed with finding cheaper ways to communicate. And so inventors like Armstrong invented new technologies that made communications cheaper. Sarnoff could invent new business models. So he really backed AM radio as a broadcasting method. Everybody had assumed it would just replace the telegraph. AT&T thought this is just one-to-one communication. He figured out, hey, if we do cheap one-way communications, one person to a million, the cost of each connection falls by many orders of magnitude, and the ability to communicate as a result explodes.
So these two friends get rich off AM radio. Then 20 years later, Armstrong invites Sarnoff up to his lab and says, hey, look, I invented FM radio. But Sarnoff's not so wild about it at that point, and slowly the friendship kind of begins to strain a bit. How come?
I really put it on the inventor, in this case, Armstrong, because his attitude was, if there's a better technology, everyone should accept it. And Sarnoff knew that wasn't the way that the world really worked. And he had to figure out how to be a little more strategic and who your enemies were going to be, how to beat them.
FM doesn't really take off the way Armstrong believes it should, though. He places the blame squarely on his friend, the head of RCA, who sells AM radio. Sarnoff denies that. In your mind, then, who gets the blame?
The FCC. Simply, and Congress behind them. So after World War II, in which FM proves itself on the battlefield, Patton loves it. It really helps his tanks beat the Nazis who are using AM radio. It's the walkie-talkies in the Pacific or FM. It's a great advantage for the U.S. Marines. They come back from World War II, and Armstrong and everybody is convinced that FM is going to take over the world. Yeah. The FCC decides the threat of FM monopolies. FM doesn't exist, but they're going to control FM. And they adopt restrictions that cripple the industry for the next three decades.
And that is the thrust of this book. And you see it today, this idea of new technologies just getting squashed by the status quo.
Absolutely. Particularly the ability to control the airwaves, these things that people use all the time, but we don't really understand. It's pretty easy to gain control of a natural resource when nobody really sees it, feels it, thinks about it that much. If you look on Verizon's balance sheet, for instance, they got $86 billion worth of airwaves. It's their biggest single asset, worth more than all of their other networks put together.
So literally the atmosphere. That's their asset.
The legal right to use specific wavelengths.
Wow.
Specifically, $86 billion. That's one company.
All right, so back to Armstrong. The FCC has its way. Stations go out of business. And by 1954 or something, Edwin Armstrong is standing on the ledge of his apartment building in Manhattan, looking to jump. Why?
So FM radio, which he'd invented two decades earlier, was a clearly superior technology, and yet it was failing. He'd been fighting this for a decade. pinning it on his friend.
David Sarnoff.
Yeah. And eventually this sense of betrayal built up. And so it's always hard to say why someone would kill themselves, yeah. but there's no question that this relationship was at the center of it.
Was Edwin Armstrong naive?
His sense of injustice and all the things he felt had happened to FM were real, but he missed the big picture. He missed the real power he was fighting. Hmm. He never knew his true enemy.
It's a book called The Network by Scott Woolley. It's about Edwin Armstrong and David Sarnoff and radio in the last century. Scott, thanks very much.
Thanks for having me.
This final note on the way out today, I called it a political fever dream yesterday, the idea that Donald Trump and Bernie Sanders were eventually going to wind up on a debate stage. And what do you know? Turns out I was right. Here's the relevant excerpt from the press release out of the Trump camp today. Quote, "Now that I am the presumptive Republican nominee, it seems inappropriate that I would debate the second place finisher. Likewise, the networks want to make a killing on these events and are not proving to be too generous to charitable causes, in this case, women's health issues. Therefore, as much as I want to debate Bernie Sanders, and it would be an easy payday, I will wait to debate the first place finisher in the Democratic Party." End of quote. Now you know. Hi, Kai Rizdahl here. Thanks for listening to this Marketplace podcast. We give you the context you need to understand what's happening in the economy and why it matters to you. So here's some context on us. We're a nonprofit service, and we rely on donations from our listeners to keep on going. And we've just made special Let's Do the Numbers Pilsner glasses available to thank you for your support. So please, donate today at marketplace.org. Oh, hey, look at the time. Got to go. The Dow up 44 points today, 0.25%. The NASDAQ up 31 points, 0.75%. The S&P 500 advanced 8 points, 0.4%. Our theme music was composed by BJ Lederman. Marketplace is produced by Nancy Fargali. Sitar Nieves is the executive producer. Deborah Clark is the vice president around here. I'm Kai Rizdahl. We're back on Monday. Have a great weekend, all 3 days, if you get it. This is APM.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
"What is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?"
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.